Hello and welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin. And we've done it. This is our review episode of 2019.
A whole season.
A whole season. This is going to be a bit more relaxed and laid back than normal. This is our last episode of 2019. It's our last episode of our first season as well. So we're going to tell you up front here that we're going to take a couple of weeks off and we'll be back in spring 2020. But this is a kind of a laid back look at what it's been like in 2019 to be a Beatles fan. And hopefully you're listening to this on the day it goes out, Christmas Day. Happy Christmas, everyone. Stop what you're doing. Listen to the podcast. If you're listening at some point in the future, we hope you're enjoying your
commute
or your holidays
Day,
or whatever you're doing. Yeah, this is a Christmas time. But has 2019 been a good year to be a Beatles fan, Stephen?
It's been an expensive year.
Oh, well, as usual. I think every year is a good year to be a Beatles fan. That's a trick question. But yeah, there's been a lot of stuff going on.
A lot of stuff out there. A lot of stuff happening.
Yes.
A lot of money spent.
Well, I think we were spoilt in 2018 because we had Egypt Station, the reemergence of Paul and the Imagine box set and the White Album box set and the what else was there? There was loads of stuff last year. This year has been a little less.
McCartney touring.
This is true. McCartney touring. But what we thought we might do is just have a little look at all the bits and pieces that have happened in 2019 that have had some kind of link to the Beatles and just kind of yak about them and then see where we stand.
I hope my bank manager isn't listening.
I hope so. You'd have can use your fake identity. The one thing I'd say is you told me back in January you went to London for the 50th anniversary of the Rooftop gig.
Yes.
But there was nothing really organised for that.
There was nothing really official.
Yeah.
But I went on one of those Beatles walks.
Oh, yes. Is that a Richard Porter?
Richard Porter.
He's a legend.
He is a legend.
Yes.
He is a legend. And it was great. I mean, it was very informative. I'd done that particular tour, that particular walk a few years ago. But when we ended up in Savile Row,
where the gig was, the rooftop.
There were, I would guess, maybe 300-400 people.
Yeah.
And we stopped the traffic. And we stood around waiting for the police to arrive and move us on, but they didn't.
Nothing happened. Nobody appeared on the roof.
You know, there were people playing cover versions. There was a Canadian television outfit, the camera crew there filming. There was someone, I gave an interview, I don't know whether it will come out, making a documentary.
Yes.
I got to meet Piers Hemmingson,
who
listeners may know, Canadian, had flown over. He's got a great book about Beatles in Canada. Check out his website. But there was a really nice kind of vibe about the whole thing. It was freezing, but we all got our...
Give you an idea of how cold it was the day the Beatles played.
We were in the street and, but it was interesting because there were people kind of hanging out of office windows to see what the hell was going on. It was...
It's an Abercrombie and Finch now, isn't it?
Fitch, the old Apple, yes, Abercrombie and Fitch.
Pardon me, the old Apple offices.
I'm down with the kids.
And somebody has broken in. Somebody on Twitter showed the picture where they broke in, went up the fire escape and made it to the roof after a number of attempts, which was...
Well, I did try the year before.
Yes.
They were doing some work and I went up to one of the workmen and literally as I walked up, he said, you can't get onto the roof. So he said, we get 20 people a day.
But what they did announce on that day, which is probably going to be the big thing for 2020, is the redo of Let It Be, that Peter Jackson of Lord of the Rings and all that kind of stuff. And he made a fantastic World War One documentary last year where he put together all the footage and made it look contemporary, cleaned it up, did speed correction.
Yep.
He's been given all the Let It Be / Get Back footage and we're going to get something in 2020.
So it's comparable to recasting World War One.
Well, yes, to give us a new lens. And there's already been, one of the websites have been reporting on it where there's already been a revisionism. It's not as bad as we remember we all were having a great time. We were a great
band. Immediately people were going, oh, here we go. It's okay. But again, Mark Lewison has sort of said, well, I've been listening.
Yeah, he listens to the tapes this year.
And he's, wasn't as bad as all that.
Yeah.
And I've always sort of thought that, if you and I have a massive row today.
It's going to happen.
And we record it.
Yeah.
And then we keep broadcasting it and we keep broadcasting it, but most people have rows in their family with their friends and people aren't talking about it 50 years later.
Yeah, I know. I suppose the big thing this year for Beatles' point of view is the Abbey Road box.
Yeah.
And I don't want to go into the minutiae of the Abbey Road box, but let's say broadly speaking, thumbs up or thumbs down on the Abbey Road box?
I think thumbs up.
Okay.
Less perhaps comprehensively thumbs up than the White Album box.
Well, then let's say out of the three boxes, my feeling out of the Sgt. Pepper box, the White Album box and the Abbey Road box, I know there's a bit of entitlement now where people expect there to be a box, whereas with Pepper we were totally surprised.
Yep.
For Pepper, that's my favourite remix. I think it's a great remix. My favourite box is the White Album box. Yep. Abbey Road would be my least favourite of the three.
I think that's right. I mean, I think I'm giving it a thumbs up because I want it.
Yep.
I think it sounds great. I think I like the Giles Martin remix. But it's probably the least interesting in terms of content and the least sort of revealing.
Yes.
Which I think is the Pepper box.
Yes, and I suppose it gives just lets you know how efficient the whole Abbey Road recording process was. You know, that it's that 6 core weeks in the summer. They weren't faffing around for months like they were for the White Album. The White Album box, I still go back to. I've kind of listened to the Abbey Road box. I'm like, well, that's great.
Yes.
But the White Album box, I still love to take out. And it has the bonus Escher stuff. It has lots going on.
I don't think the Abbey Road box is something I'm going to be going back to a lot.
I am curious to see if a Get Back Let It Be box, what that encapsulates, how they make that work.
Initially, I was very excited about the idea that, you know, the Peter Jackson movie, and that there's going to be a lot of footage, there's going to be a lot of outtakes, there's going to be a fantastic box set. But then the Abbey Road... What I don't like is this idea that they simply get outtakes and, you know, they put them in the same order as the running order of the album and you get one version of each. Yeah. And in the book that comes with the Abbey Road box set, they're kind of saying, but there's this other amazing outtake, or you should have heard this version. And I'm thinking, do it or don't do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I suppose we're spoiled by the Escher demos, but I'd be very annoyed if we get, 12 Let It Be outtakes, which are alternative versions of...
But there is capacity for that. There's so much stuff recorded.
Yes, yes.
The other Beatles release just before Christmas was the singles box. Did you get that?
I did pick up the singles box.
You just couldn't. I just couldn't.
I have so many versions of it. I have the cassette singles. I have the, 87 singles. I took it out. I looked at the sleeves. I read the little book. I put it back in the box and I put it on the shelf.
Yeah, I have not succumbed to it yet. There is the Super Deluxe Edition website. Paul Sinclair, the guy who runs that, has put up an unboxing video, and it does look nice.
It's very nice, but the content box is just you're getting it because it's a nice thing.
It does have,
it's an object.
I know we did an episode on double A sides, but it does have the best double A side in there of Free as a Bird, Real Love.
Yes.
As the bonus single, which I would actually be like, you haven't even listened to that to see the new mix?
I don't know. Yeah, I'm going to have to do that.
Go sort that out and let us know. Yeah. So, yeah, the singles box, it is physically a nice thing. It does go well with the other boxes. I personally don't understand the point of 7-inch boxes. You know, I think the number one thing, unless
he said sitting in front of the Christmas box,
even though there's a Christmas box set hanging around here, of stuff that you can get on an album, because you're kind of getting up and down, and they're nice physical things, and they seem to have done a nice physical job with it recently. But Abbey Road and the singles box have been the big 2019 Beatles things. 2020 will be interesting. Individual Beatles wise,
it's all about Paul.
We had the Egypt Station Traveller Edition, Explorer Edition reissue, which some people wake up Stephen, don't fall asleep.
Many editions of this album are there?
Not enough. I love Egypt Station.
I liked Egypt Station, but I like it less every time there's a new edition.
Well, I'm going to say that I think the bonus, because at the time, Egypt Station, I didn't buy it the week it came out. And
Were you ill? Housebound?
The one I wanted in a very dull collector's way, I wanted to get the double, triple, trifold vinyl, double vinyl colored thing, and it sold out. And so I was like, oh, what'll I buy now? So I ended up, I after a few weeks, I bought it on CD, and then I bought the triple vinyl. I did actually buy
the
new triple vinyl expanded edition, because I think the bonus tracks that came out this year are great.
This is what I find really annoying.
You know,
the bonus tracks, particularly the recent Black Friday. I really like those two tracks.
Well, Paul has closed out the year, with two new tracks that came out in November 2019. What are they called? In a Hurry and. I can't remember. I told you this was loose.
But they're great.
Home Tonight.
Home Tonight. They're two really good,
yes,
catchy
they
tracks.
Are excellent
and
tracks.
And they are better than tracks that made the cut.
They are from the Egypt Station sessions.
But they're from the same sessions.
Yeah.
And this for me, it's the same, you know, he has form.
Well, I have a theory. I think Home Tonight was left off because it covers the same ground as Come On To Me.
Mm.
It's like, hey, yeah, we're scoring, we're going home, yeah, we're doing all that kind of
spit distasteful
sexy granddad stuff.
Yeah.
And
hey, granddad.
Yes. Oh, well, that's on my list of Paul.
Of course.
But I think In A Hurry, with its kind of tempo change, fake ending, it's great. That
he
should
could
have
dropped,
been on.
Drop that Brazilian track.
Yeah, I like that. Caesar Rock could have dropped
Caesar
that.
Caesar Rock.
You know.
Yeah. But I think, well, have we got something like 7, 8?
Yeah,
tracks from the Egypt Station that have now come out.
Yeah,
have been drip fed
because Nothing for Free was one of the bonus tracks. Yeah. That's a top song as well. You
but
know,
he's
Frank Sinatra's party.
But he's touring.
Yes,
so he's announced dates
for 2020.
He had 7 tracks or 8 tracks that would have formed the core
of a new album. Yeah.
You know, I it annoys me intensely when anyone does it, but I think I cannot off the top of my head think of another album where there are so many iterations.
And I do think the massive edition with all the doohickeys, and I couldn't be bothered.
Your little suitcase?
No way.
You don't want a little
Paul
McCartney?
There's only so much space. But the interesting thing, Frank Sinatra's party, some other super fan had to point this out. It goes back to like a mid-70s instrumental demo, which I found quite strange. But yeah, it's been busy in the world of Paul. He released his Hey Grandude children's book, so that's on a lot of Christmas lists. He supported Linda McCartney's photographic exhibition and the re-release of Wild Prairie. He got a Gold Blue Peter badge. Yay!
Highlight of his career,
Of his career. What didn't happen was we didn't get an archive collection, which is quite annoying. And the rumours are either it's going to be London Town Back to the Egg, and then that rumour seems to have switched to Flaming Pie is the next archive collection. So that might be a 2020 thing to look forward to. And he re-released some live albums on vinyl during the summer. But one of them was essentially a previously unreleased album, the Amoeba Gig album.
Yeah.
And that's fantastic.
It's great. I have to say, it is very, very good. It is very good. And I know I'm Team George, but I went to see Paul in Las Vegas.
Now, this was very interesting. You went off and saw a couple of gigs in the States. Stones,
Aerosmith.
And you saw Paul in Vegas.
Yeah.
And your feedback from that I found really interesting, because you're saying it's a totally different vibe.
It's a totally different vibe. I mean, you and I went to see him in
Liverpool
in December 18. And I suppose, like me, you were maybe thinking, hometown gig, this is going to be something absolutely amazing. It was great.
It was a great gig.
It was a great gig. There were a couple of real kind of spine-tingling moments for me, and I think for you as well. It was From Me to You.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Was this acoustic skiffly version, which really, if you, I said this to you at the time, you know, if you'd asked me before I went into the gig, which song is the most likely to kind of get the hair on the back of your neck standing up, From Me to You wouldn't have featured at all.
Yeah,
but there was just something about that. But anyway, what I found in America, it was essentially the same set list.
Yes,
and it was in Las Vegas in the T-Mobile Arena, so similar to the Echo Arena in Liverpool. The difference was the reaction of the audience.
Yeah.
So I was on the floor, sitting at the floor seating, maybe about 20 or 30 rows back, and that audience just adore Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
In Liverpool, you know, people were chatting, people were going back and forward.
We had
drinks.
A particularly obnoxious group of people in front of us
really
in Liverpool.
Bad, yeah. But in America, you know, I think in the UK, Paul has that slightly embarrassing uncle, naff, you know, mullet guitar.
He's still a national treasure.
He's a national treasure, but there's a kind of cynicism or a kind of, you know, they don't accord respect to national treasures particularly. In America, he is
adored.
Beatle Paul.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He is Paul McCartney from the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
And when he did All My Loving.
Yeah.
You could just feel the adoration in the crowd. And it was a totally different. And I have to say, although it was the same set list, and I maybe didn't get the same buzz off From Me to You as I did in Liverpool because I was hearing it for the second time, overall, the concert experience was just incredible.
Side point, were the Stones good?
The Stones were brilliant. Yeah. It was the second gig of their rescheduled tour.
Yeah.
And I think they had something to... I mean, I've seen the Stones a dozen times more in 20 or 30 years. They were as good as I ever saw them.
Yeah, I saw them the Dublin gig last year in 2018. I thought it was amazing. And I wasn't really expecting it to be as good as it was.
No, it was sensational. But I enjoyed McCartney better simply because of the crowd. And if I could just say, I met a guy called Brad Verbe.
Yeah.
Shout out to him if he's listening. He was there with his dad who printed the sleeves for the Beatle albums.
Amazing.
So you meet all the best people at Paul McCartney gigs.
And if we overlap into Ringo, because Paul ended the tour by bringing Ringo out on stage, which he did in London.
In London,
just before Christmas 2018.
The gig we didn't get to.
The gig we didn't go to instead of going to Liverpool. And he brought Ringo out, and was it Helter Skelter they did? What was it? And
Get Back, probably.
Yeah, and it's just amazing. Just Paul and Ringo in this massive...
I cannot imagine what the reaction in America...
It must be extraordinary to see the two of them together. Yeah. And, you know, they still got it. But the other thing, if we sidle on to Ringo's 2019, is he released a new album.
Yes.
What's My Name? And Paul is on it. And Paul plays with him on a John Lennon song, Grow Old With Me, produced by Jack Douglas or...
Arranged by
Jack Douglas. And it's lovely.
It is. It is. It's very nice. I have to say, I like this album.
Okay.
It's a Ringo Starr album. You know, your expectations are it's a Ringo Starr album. It's not going to change the world. But I have to say, there are three or four songs that are excellent. You know, new songs. There's a version of Money, the Barrett Strong song that the Beatles covered on with the Beatles. It's hilariously funny because he's auto-tuned deliberately, it's kind of a jokey song. But there are a couple of great songs. I like Grow Old With Me. I think it's maybe a little bit of a missed opportunity in the sense that Paul is mixed so, the vocals are mixed so low.
Yeah.
It could be anybody or it could be no one.
Yeah.
And maybe Paul insisted on that, or maybe Ringo didn't want to overshadow things.
But he
was trading a lot on the fact that it's a John song, Paul's on it, I'm singing it. There's a little lift from George's Here Comes the Sun in the string arrangement.
Yes.
So I was expecting Paul to be a bit more present. The bass playing is excellent.
It is, though.
It's really good.
It's a really good bass line. Yeah. And he's, you know, you just have to stop and think, oh, there's Paul playing bass on a Lennon composition. Yeah. You know, that is not a normal thing. But it seems like a dumb thing to say, I love it when Ringo plays the drums.
Yes.
I love it when he plays the drums.
Yeah.
And he's done two great bits of drumming this year, which was he's on Jenny Lewis's album, and he plays on that, and he's absolutely fantastic.
You know it's him.
You do know it's him, you know?
Even if he wasn't credited.
Head's Gonna Roll is the track, and it's just fantastic. But the other thing that popped up online was he plays on this version of the band's The Wait, which is this kind of international thing where people record their bits all around the world, and Robbie Robertson's involved, and Ringo kind of introduces it. And he just...
It's sensational.
It is fantastic. And that little Ringo swing, that little lolloping thing that he does, suits the song down to the ground.
It is. It's different. Brilliant. I mean, it's different from the Leave on Helm drum part on the original, but it's just perfect.
Yes.
And it's for all the kind of cast of people that are on that recording, Ringo is the one that stands out.
And he popped up as well on Jimmy Fallon doing Yellow Submarine. So Jimmy Fallon does these clips where people play songs with children's instruments.
I know who Jimmy Fallon is.
I'm explaining it to the one person at home who doesn't know who Jimmy Fallon is. We've got a worldwide audience.
I don't listen. I don't watch Jimmy Fallon, obviously,
sure,
but I know who
you tape it for the next day.
Yeah. The next generation.
But he does these fantastic... Listen, the secret sauce in Jimmy Fallon's show is The Roots. The Roots are an extraordinary...
I have seen it. It's very, very funny.
So Ringo
does
Yellow
Submarine. Doing
yes.
That was excellent.
And Ringo and The Roots and Jimmy Fallon do a very charming version of Yellow Submarine, and it's just super that, you know, that's part of the consciousness. But yeah, Ringo drumming is the best, and I wish throughout all his career he had just decided to not do the club singer stuff and just be the greatest drummer that he is. But anyway, that's Ringo's 2019. Lennon, there wasn't much. There was a 50th anniversary release of the Wedding album.
Everybody's must-have release of the year.
I'm going to be honest, I never listened to that album until this year. And it's good. For what it is, it's very, very good.
Did you listen to the whole of the John Yoko 20-minute?
Yeah.
Really? All the way through?
Yeah.
You're excellent. Well done. Well done.
You deserve a
gold Blue Peter badge for that.
I kind of think this... this podcast means I have to do things like that. Well, I have it's like, to tick that off my list.
Well, it's like I know that someday this podcast is going to force me to watch Give My Regards to Bob Speak.
Yeah, that day is coming.
So if you've listened to the wedding album, I suppose I can't really. what I would say about these, it's secretly Canadian, is the...
they do a great job.
Reissues of Yoko's catalogue, and this is sort of part of that,
yeah,
are just incredible. Yeah. It's Sean Lennon is overseeing the sort of remastering, and the care and the attention to detail on these is just phenomenal. I mean, I wouldn't be recommending the wedding album in terms of audio content as the starting point, but it's just a fantastic package put together.
And the only other real Lennon thing this year was the Imagine, the raw studio version of Imagine that was in the box set from last year, came out on vinyl for Record Store Day.
Yes.
That's just...
I have to say, I liked it. I eventually ended up buying the box set.
Oh, okay.
And I just found it very difficult to find a way in. Just there's so much of it.
There is a lot on that.
But I actually thought the Record Store Day LP was a very nice sort of introductory.
I have become a big fan in the last couple of years of these alternative versions of albums. The alternative Pepper on the two vinyl Pepper version. You know, when you want to listen to something new and the exact same at the same time, those alternate album versions. There's a great Record Store Day have done a great reorganizing of the Fleetwood Mac catalogue as well. And then George Harrison's 2019, If I Could Make the Sound of Crickets, I Would, you know.
You just dub that from Abbey Road. we can.
Yes. There's on his website, I went to his website to see what was under the news section. There was three things: 50th anniversary of his demo session in 69, the death of racing legend Niki Lauda, and the Here Comes the Sun video. There's no standalone George Harrison release, and we must be wondering whether 2020 is going to give us 50th anniversary George treats.
Yes.
You just hope that's going to happen.
All things must pass. You think is you know, he expressed a wish to kind of go back and strip that back.
Yeah.
And I think Early Takes is your favourite George Harrison.
I love that record. It's brilliant.
And I think that is a tantalising and incredibly frustrating glimpse, a little tiny window into what must be a huge archive. What I would also say is it's the Delaney and Bonnie tour.
Oh, yeah, 50th anniversary.
The 50th anniversary. And they gathered, I think it's five. I haven't got the box. I'm not sure I'd be prepared to listen to five identical concert with George on rhythm guitar in the background, but there's a little kind of I think two CD box.
Yes,
but that's the only other George content that I'm aware of.
And then if we kind of go into the any other business part of the things, there's been a couple of books. And in the end is a
books.
Beatle books.
People are writing books about
somebody should write a good book about the Beatles.
Is there a market for that?
I would say so. I've read And in the End, which is a good book.
Ken McNabb, fantastic.
Fantastic book. Really enjoyable. And what I like is it breaks 1969 down into month by month chapters, and it works very well as with the Beatles 66 book.
It is. It's a really what I liked about this book is we know the story and we know how it ends.
Yes.
But he makes a really compelling narrative across the year. It's anybody hasn't got it, get it on your...
I have to admit, the other book I haven't read is Solid State. I don't know, have you read that book yet?
No, that's on my Christmas list.
Okay, that's fine.
I'm saying that's on my Christmas
list. Oh, you're telling me that now. Yeah. Well, I have a surprise for you. I don't. but I think the thing we want to spend the next hour talking about is the movie Yesterday.
Okay.
Maybe not. Have you seen Yesterday?
No.
I went to see Yesterday.
You said you weren't going to see it.
I said I wasn't going to see it.
I was the one that was enthusiastic and thinking, yeah, this will be great. And then I didn't go to see it. You did go to see it and you loved it.
In fairness, I loved it. I enjoyed it. My brother rang me up and he'd gotten preview tickets. So we went to see it.
So it was free?
Yes.
Ah.
So it was worth every penny. And it is what it is. It's you know, the synopsis it's written by
Richard Curtis.
It's directed by Danny Boyle, and it tells the story of a busker who has an accident, and the world has this kind of odd state of flux. And when he wakes up after the accident, he's the only person who can remember the Beatles songs.
He ends up in an episode of Goodnight Sweetheart.
Yeah, pretty much. And he rewrites all the songs, and he becomes super famous on the back of it. And it's charming. It's interesting. The things I thought about were, you know, I find it odd that the Beatles don't have a certain modern day cachet that Queen do or ABBA do or ELO do in terms of their songs and their popularity.
ELO?
Yeah.
Queen, ABBA, ELO.
Yeah, that's kind of how I see it. But you know what I mean. Like, okay, Fleetwood Mac.
Yeah.
Fleetwood Mac then, instead of ELO. That they have but at the same time, I don't know what other band could have formed the cornerstone of that story. It kind of had to be
the Beatles. Yeah.
And in the film's defense, I think Danny Boyle is a great director. He's made some great films, and he is the saving grace of that film, because I find whenever Richard Curtis directs his films, they are maudlin dross. And so he kind of keeps it tight and keeps it nipping along. It's not a perfect film,
but it's not going into the serious business of what would the wider world look like without the Beatles.
Absolutely not. It is a paper thin premise.
I mean, I read an article where someone was saying, "Oh, but this is the music business does not work this way," and there's lots of people who are, you know, the premise is that these songs are so good in and of themselves that anybody could take them into the charts, and that's not the way.
No,
that, you know.
And if you start picking it like that, this is a movie
it's
to watch.
Entertainment.
With your brain off when it's on ITV2 at 10 o'clock on a Friday night. You know, it's that kind of film.
Okay.
And there's one joke, there's one band that doesn't exist in the present day because the Beatles didn't exist.
Okay.
And that band is?
ELO.
Oasis. That's the joke.
Oh.
Not ELO.
You spoiled it for everyone.
Sorry. Well, there is a scene which I won't spoil it, but it happens, you know, about three quarters of the way in. And that does make you think, that scene. And but it's fine. It's a fine film, but it's whatever. The other thing we've mentioned before that came out this year that I also want to give a thumbs up to is the McGeer box set.
Yes.
Mike McGeer's album has been re-released in a lovely 2 CD, 1 DVD, clamshell box, full of notes, full of music, full of tunes. It's Paul's brother Mike with Paul and Wings making a fantastic, crazy pop record in 10cc studios.
It is just sensational.
Yeah,
it is just sensational. And someone said to me, you know, imagine if Mike had written all the lyrics for Paul's songs.
That's a great thing, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that might be something to discuss at more length in a future episode.
What I wished, because I went back to McGeer this year when that came out and I listened to it a whole bunch of times, is, I think I might have said this before, but I wished that it had been a thing Paul had done every 7 or 8 years.
Yeah.
That there'd just be a McGeer, kind of the way he does The Fireman or whatever, that him and Mike would make a record and they could both lay their burdens down and just do this kind of funky thing.
This is what I like so much about this. And if it weren't that the Abbey Road box set had come out this year, the McGeer album I think would be my reissue of the year. It's just amazing. There's a really entertaining little DVD that comes with it with Mike. He's very dry sense of humor.
Very dry sense. He has a really good attitude to the whole brother of Paul thing.
Yeah,
he's fantastic.
I can't praise this album highly enough.
Yeah.
But if you draw a straight line from Red Rose Speedway to McCartney 2, I think McGeer sits right in the middle.
Yeah.
That it's where Paul, as you say, he's kind of free of the constraints of being Paul McCartney, and he can kind of cut loose in the studio.
Yeah, there's a song, Giving Grease a Ride, on that album, and I think there's a direct line to that. And, you know, Mr. H. Atom from the McCartney 2 sessions, they're the exact same version. They're two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
So that's fantastic. Outside of the Beatles, Stephen, I'm going to put you on the spot. Anything from 2019, like your favourite record, anything you'd listen to that you liked that you'd give a thumbs up to?
No, I just listened to the Beatles.
I did get my Spotify thing this week and it said the artist you've listened to most this year is the Beatles, and this decade, the Beatles. I was like, am I really that predictable?
I think I've lost track of time because we've been doing this podcast, but is Negative Capability by Marianne Faithfull?
That was last year.
That
your favourite album last year.
Well, that was my favourite album for last year. That's still my favourite album.
Okay, fair enough.
My favourite non-Beatles album for the last 2 years has been Marianne Faithfull.
Anything old you found this year that you've
Anything
liked?
Old? I got a copy of SF Sorrow by Pretty Things.
Oh, yeah.
Which wasn't really an album that I knew much about.
Yes.
And that was a good rediscovery.
Yeah, that's a good choice.
And you?
Thank you for asking. I would say...
You're down with the kids.
I'm down with the kids. I really enjoyed the Vampire Weekend album this year. Mm-hmm. After they'd been away for a while, I do love Vampire Weekend. And I would say in terms of old stuff, in the last 2 or 3 months, I've had a sudden... Finally, after many nudgings from you over the years, awakenings into King Crimson and how insanely good King Crimson are. And now it's, you know, the thing when you get into something and it just tips over into, I need to listen to everything. So I've been going through
there's lots of 28 and 30 CD box sets.
I don't know, am I at there yet? But they gave away a few months ago in Mojo, they gave away a free King Crimson.
That's a very good
alternate compilation. Yep. And that was the thing that finally, I put that on one day and I was like, wait a second.
So it wasn't my endless recommendations.
It wasn't you. And
no,
I mean,
you were ignoring those and just went with
Mojo. I'd always had a soft spot for like Crimson, you know, In the Court of the Crimson King and Red. But this thing was like, oh, I see the whole,
I saw them live this year.
And I now regret not going. And you told me to go, and I
did ask you to go.
I know.
It was a great gig. It was an excellent gig.
Yeah, he's a fascinating man, Robert Fripp. And 2020, I suppose the things to look forward to are, I guess, some of the things we've talked about: the Get Back, Let It Be project. Hopefully, mm-hmm. some Paul McCartney archives. Hopefully, an All Things Must Pass box. And I'm sure there'll be some curveballs as well.
I think the Let It Be box set is potentially the best release box set, or potentially the most frustrating.
Yes, I agree. You know. And it depends whether they bother to put the early versions of the Get Back album in there, they're going to package the old film with the new film, you know, all that kind of stuff.
It's audio content. There's so much that was crammed in, and some of it unlistenable.
Yeah.
But some of it is great that you've heard from bootlegs, and you really just wish they get this right.
Yeah, I know. Now, folks, as we mentioned at the start of this episode, this is going to be the last episode of season one of Nothing Is Real, and our last episode of 2019. We are going to come back. We're going to come back in a couple of weeks' time, in spring of 2020, and we're going to do another batch of shows, and we'll tighten up the ship, and we'll, you know, it'd be generally the same thing, maybe a few little tweaks here and there. We don't know, but there's a couple of things we just want to say. First of all, we want to say thanks to everyone who's listened and everyone who's downloaded, but there's also another person, there's a third leg, there's a Brian Epstein, there's a George Martin behind all of this, who needs a bit of a shout out. And so on the Wheels of Steel, producing all of this and editing it and putting the music on and making sure we don't sound like we're recorded in the back of a tin can, is our producer, Adrian Carty. And we're going to let Adrian come on mic. Hello, Ado.
Hello.
This is the first time. Okay?
This is fine. This is all right.
All right. I won't overstep the mark.
Don't do anything. But we did actually, we decided, Ado, to thank you for all your hard work. We've bought you a present for the Christmas season. As we said, we're in here doing this episode live on Christmas Day. And
it's good that he's given up time.
It is very kind.
Is Bruce Springsteen in this box?
Bruce Springsteen is not in that box. No. He is not that small. But Ado is happens to be my cousin and has been very helpful in helping us put this whole enterprise together.
Very patient.
Very patient, because I don't think he even likes the Beatles.
Well, I'm aware of the Beatles.
Favourite Beatle?
Ringo.
Of course.
That's fair enough.
And I'll tell you why, because you just touched on earlier on that it's so lovely to see Ringo play the drums.
Yes.
It's just so lovely, as if he's just, you know, have a little day out here for yourself, old Ringo, and just bash away in the drums.
Yeah,
that's kind of the thing.
He's absolutely fantastic. So that's our gift to you.
Lando Calrissian, for listeners at home.
Which is, if you recall in our Please Please Me episode...
Is there a quiz? There's a quiz question. You get to keep it if you can answer the question.
Well, on our Please Please Me episode, we pointed out that Billy Dee Williams was the only person to record...
Oh, a callback.
Yes, it's a callback.
Very good.
And that's the only time I can recall in any episode where you got in any way animated or excited because we mentioned a Star Wars reference.
And he is in the next one.
Which is
the last one.
Spoiler alert.
The Rise of Skywalker is going to be out next.
It's out already.
It's out already.
Because it's now Christmas Day.
I've been so busy
watching you
doing this that I haven't had a chance.
I haven't had a chance
yet.
We will let you out of the studio in order to go see the latest Star Wars.
Because Christmas Day is my day to go to the cinema. That's what I'll be doing.
But we thank Ado for all his hard work. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Now, you suggested that we solicit questions to round up the season.
Solicit questions?
To procure questions from our
audience. To get our audience involved.
Yes,
suppose,
to do a little bit of...
in the proceedings,
Yes, interactivity.
Two people have written in.
One is Annette Curtin.
Excellent.
Hey, the old one. No, there is a lot of questions. I suppose the easiest way to do this is a kind of a quick fire round.
Okay.
Now, for the listener, you have not seen these questions.
No.
You don't know what they are. There's a couple of requests for your PIN number. I'll leave that up to you guys. I wouldn't spend a lot of time answering these. Or you can if you want.
Okay.
Because there is a lot of them.
Okay.
Like 10 minutes a question?
15 minutes a question.
Okay.
All right.
And then I can edit it down to 30 seconds. That's kind of what usually happens. So we'll go from the top. Somebody just taken from Facebook and Twitter and email and some questions I have of my own as well.
Okay.
All right.
Yes.
Okay. So, first one from Facebook is from Nick Morfitt. Do you think Carnival of Light will ever get released?
I hope not.
I hope not too. It seems that it's going to eventually come out at some point, but it will be the biggest anticlimax of all time. And the whole reason it's anyway interesting is because we haven't heard it. That's basically it.
I think so. I think so. If you listen to the some of the messing around on the Christmas records, I think it's going to be something like that. Let's hope not, but it will eventually.
It'll eventually. Everything comes to pass, but not anytime soon, I don't think.
Okay. How much do we really know about Paul apparently helping John and Yoko reconcile their relationship in 1974 after the Pang affair?
Well, this is part of the official John and Yoko narrative, is that Paul met Yoko in New York and then flew out to LA and said, you know, if you want to get back together with Yoko, you're going to have to court her. And I don't know. It's impossible to know. My sense is probably that it's overplayed. I can't see Paul rocking up at Yoko's door in 73 or 74 and having that kind of heart-to-heart conversation.
But we definitely have evidence that Paul was with John at that time.
Yes.
And there are parts in the timeline that do match up.
Yes, the timeline is there. I think it happened. I think something happened. But
yes.
I suspect in the official narrative, it's probably overplayed.
What was in it for John? For Paul.
Paul just wanted to, I think, be John's mate, and again, you know, he just...
The irony is that again, in the official narrative, is that it was John getting back with Yoko that effectively prevented John
and
flying
Paul
down to New Orleans to record with Paul when Paul was doing Venus and Mars. There is a kind of flip side to that.
Right, interesting. That's from Richard Tannehill Wood. Owen Ling asks, McGeer is gorgeous work lyrically. Could Paul have benefited with Mike's words on his albums?
Well, that's what we were just saying a minute ago. So that must have been Owen who gave us the idea. So
I think that's just a fantastic alternative universe.
Reality.
Where he's working with Mike McGeer as a lyricist.
Yeah.
I really think that, again, the McGeer album, everybody should own it. And I think that's probably worthy of further discussion at some point.
Okay. David Chandler, House on Fire,
hey,
one
Dave.
Beatles album to grab on the way out. Which one?
One Beatles album to grab.
Yeah.
I'm a Pepper Man to my core.
White album.
Originals or reissues?
Original mono with the poster. Yeah.
I don't mind. I'll take the 2017 version. That's fine.
I go for the mini disc version myself.
Of course.
Susanna Marerius, I think it would be really interesting if one of the questions about your perception of the Beatles has changed over the years. And what are the main differences in your relationship with the band between when you became a fan and the present times?
Well, I mean, I think one of the interesting things is that our age difference, I'm much older.
You're
than
not
Jason.
That much older.
There was still a possibility when I became a fan that they might get back together. So this was kind of the late 70s. It seemed very, very real. And I was absolutely obsessed with that notion. So I suppose that was the big change. And you go through phases. So where I stopped listening to the Beatles because I don't really, I know the songs and I don't, but the whole sort of reissue program has kind of changed again, and I'm fascinated at getting those.
I would say when I was a teenager in the late 80s, getting into the Beatles, they're just like the best, but it's all a retrospective thing, it's a background thing. And then on the coattails of that, there was Anthology, which kind of shook everything up again. But I probably stopped listening to the Beatles for about 10 years, and it's only the reissues from 2009 onwards. With the fact that, you know, as you get older, you tend to fall back on the stuff you like, or you might tend to listen to less new music and all that kind of stuff. But I found that going back in the last 10 years, you're like, this stuff, and I know I mentioned this before, you initially think, oh, I wasn't there at the time, that's a pity. But then you kind of realize going forward, actually, no, this constantly means a different thing as time passes. And a lot of art doesn't do that. It kind of disappears.
I absolutely agree with that. It changes. Your perception changes.
So to listen to this stuff and it's now 50 years out, it kind of, it's almost kind of starting to stand on its own, you know, and it is this kind of, they're going to end up being like these kind of Shakespeare figures of pop music.
But you made a good point earlier on that the Rolling Stones,
yeah,
they're still going and they're still releasing stuff and so on. So if the Beatles are still going, your perception probably would have changed.
Oh, absolutely.
Because it's isolated in that kind of region.
I think
of
every
music.
Beatle fan knows it's bittersweet, but the best thing they ever did was go away. And you kind of don't want to say that out loud, but I think it's true.
Well, you've just recorded it now.
Oh, God, is that thing on? Have we been recording all of these? That's a disgrace.
I think that's right. If you look at those kind of key artists, and the you know, I'm thinking particularly the Stones or someone like Neil Young.
Yeah,
I always sort of think each album, each new album, sort of dilutes the legacy slightly. Whereas the Beatles, you've got that time capsule.
Well, Neil Young in particular. Like,
but I don't deny anybody.
I'm a huge Neil Young fan, but really, nothing measures up.
I don't deny anybody putting out those records. Like, Neil Young is free to do what he wants, and he does do what he wants, and he's great. But he's fighting against himself, unfortunately.
Yeah. There's a couple of questions, but I'll just put into one, I suppose, from Mike Tate. Which producers got the best out of the Macca solo years?
I think Greg Kurstin has done a fantastic job with Egypt Station. I think he's been a brilliant producer, and I know a lot of people love Chaos and Creation, and that's a great album, but you know it's a Nigel Godrich album. You know, it sounds like, you know, the way the drums sound on Beck's Sea Change and all that kind of stuff. And Jeff Lynne gets all this grief for sounding like Jeff Lynne. Nigel Godrich sounds like Nigel Godrich as well, folks. Get used to it. So, but I find Greg Kurstin, he brought in a kind of a very curious playfulness, because Greg Kirsten's thing seems to me that he makes the band sound like themselves. He works with Foo Fighters, they sound like Foo Fighters. He does his Birds and the Bees stuff, and that's great. And so I thought he did a really, really good job producing Paul on that record. I thought he was really great.
Well, I obviously have to defer to Jason on all things Paul. I think I would agree with that, and particularly the comments about Nigel Godrich.
Yeah.
Very quick fire one here from Wayne Shields. What are your Beatles Desert Island discs? And an arbitrary number by Wayne. 8 songs each.
Oh,
so
geez.
Let's not do 8 songs each. Let's do 3 songs each.
Okay, you start.
Here Comes the Sun.
Okay. We're doing
you
back
get
and
alternate.
Forth.
Okay. Oh, right. Come on, like. Okay.
It's impossible.
Here Comes the Sun.
Yeah.
Revolution.
Okay.
And probably something off the White Album. I Will. Okay. That's only because I'm giving a kind of equal.
Yeah.
John Paul George.
Okay. I think I'd have to choose A Day in the Life. I might choose Hey Jude. I don't know. Maybe a curveball like The Ballad of John Yoko. I can't. I find this
not
hard.
Not a George song amongst them.
No, that's totally on purpose. If I had to choose a George song.
That's tricky on the spot.
That's a really tricky on the spot. If I choose a George song again, I think I'd probably choose Long, Long, Long.
Yeah, good choice.
Okay. Now, we're not going to answer all these questions, but you'll go back. Stephen will go back on Facebook and answer each one of these in detail.
I don't do Facebook.
Here's a lovely one from William Hinson. How have you grown as friends by making this podcast?
Well,
have we?
I didn't like him then. I don't like him now.
Well, I can say as an impartial observer that Stephen records this in a different studio. Jason records a different studio, and then I put it all together and make it sound
seamless,
like in the same room. But you're not in the same room.
It is like
you hate each other.
It's like the Ebony and Ivory video.
Yeah.
It's very much like that.
Yeah,
I don't know. Obviously, the whole podcast is a subtext for male friendship in the 21st century.
Well, you are holding hands now. You can see this at home, but they're holding hands all the time. They hold hands every time.
I have to say it's an odd thing, because we kind of met through music, through the Word blog, the Word magazine, had a kind of face-to-face meetup in Dublin, and we met then, and we kind of then went to a gig together, and then I suppose it's the Dublin Beatles Festival.
Yeah,
kind of was the notion of this, and that has kind of elevated things, and now we're moving in together in a kind of terrace house.
It's like Morecambe and Wise living in the same kitchen. It is odd, and obviously the podcast, you're kind of, there's a heightened version of your sense of self or your sense of talking or friendship and all the rest. So it's been odd, because we're not broadcasters. So it's been a good experience.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely.
Okay. From Jerome Corby, as another question for you, more so. Is No More Lonely Nights the best song McCartney did post Beatles?
Possibly.
It's My Love is the best
song. Oh, God, no. No, I think No More Lonely Nights is a fantastic song. It's certainly the best song he's done post-Beatles that he has never done live or that he's never gone back to or that he's never really acknowledged, you know? And it's the only decent song on that Paul McCartney tribute album from a few years ago, The Art of McCartney. A group called Airborne Toxic Event did a nice string quartet version of No More Lonely Nights.
Why hasn't he acknowledged it? Why doesn't he get back to it?
It sort of came out in a period of time when he wasn't touring because he didn't really tour in the 80s. And he just doesn't. There's a bunch of songs he just never touches live.
But it's associated perhaps
with Give My Regards to Broad Street, which could be a problem.
So I think there's a kind of psychological.
But the other reason might be it's really hard to sing. And that might be a bit mundane, but actually if you go and listen to No More Lonely Nights, or even if you try and sing along with
it
starts quite low in the verses and then it goes up really high in the choruses. It's not an easy song to physically sing. Mm. So that could be reason enough why he's never gone near it.
Dave Gilmour guitar
Dave Gilmour plays a fantastic
guitar.
You've
got to replicate that live.
Yeah.
That'd be tricky.
Yeah.
Okay. Paul is dead.
Oh, no, let's skip
that again.
That.
Do you think... No. I think we can... Would you have liked the Beatles to have carried on for a few more years, or are you glad they pulled the curtain down when they did? You've kind of answered that.
We've kind of answered that already.
James Cordell has answered that.
I think maybe there was one more.
I do think there was one more, you know.
If you look at those first run of solo albums and Ringo's, It Don't Come Easy, I would love It Don't Come Easy to have been the last.
And there's also
Beatles number one, you know.
Also, there is form for 60s groups doing really good stuff right at the start of the 70s. Exile on Main Street, Who's Next, the Kinks stuff, you know. So you know, a good Beatles album in 71, 72. Mm. Yeah.
But I think you touched on that earlier. I think the fact that they have a little kind of discreet body of work, I think that's what's preserved the legend.
Yeah.
Okay. So a couple of other kind of questions have been culled from places. Billie Eilish, who you've talked about before.
Yep.
She recently got eviscerated by middle-aged men that she didn't know who Van Halen was.
Yeah.
And people are outraged, as they usually are, with these type of stupid things. I don't know why people want to die on that rock about Van Halen. But the Beatles, I suppose, culturally and musically, they're always ubiquitous. Now, cynically, you could say there's a great relevance to them, keep them going from a commerce point of view.
Yeah,
but also because, and we've talked about this, you guys have talked about it so much, that within that very condensed few years they were together, they produced a lot of music and did a lot of work together. So if you ask Billie Eilish about the Beatles, she'd go, I know who they are.
Yeah.
So well, what is it that still makes them culturally relevant, apart from commerce?
They have a sort of, they kind of have a, they're like a Rosetta Stone for like translating an awful lot of pop culture and music, you know, their body of work. You can go back to it. I mean, just let me state for the record that Billie Eilish is 10 times as good the artist that Van Halen are. I would say, you know, I think she's, her stuff this year has been extraordinary. She did turn up, I don't know if you saw the footage of her playing Glastonbury this summer 2019. She turned up wearing livery designed by Stella McCartney that's covered in iconography from the Yellow Submarine cartoon. So she's very clearly knows who the Beatles are and is sticking her flag in Camp Beatles. And as I said, I think she's been a fantastic noise this year. I mean, I thought it was an odd, that whole Van Halen thing, because Van Halen, you know, really, you know, does anyone think about Van Halen that much anymore?
No.
I think they're the worst big band.
Yeah, I can't really comment on her output because I sort of lost track after that song, Nice Day for a White Wedding.
Billie Eilish, you crap. That's a terrible
cut that out.
But the Beatles, why I think the Beatles is they took all of the sort of basic building blocks of rock and roll from sort of Little Richard and Elvis and the kind of show tunes and things like that, and they just changed everything. So they took those influences and created something entirely new in terms of the music, the songwriting, the touring, the albums, whether it's artwork, lyrics on sleeves, all of those things. So, but everything that came after them, with a possible exception, I suppose, of sort of electronic music, although they were starting to kind of dabble in that. And if you listen to some of the stuff that John did with Yoko, and it has that kind of electronic. But absolutely everything that comes after is influenced by what they
And it kind of feeds back to the things we were just saying a few minutes ago. You can listen to the Beatles in your teens and enjoy a certain version of the Beatles, and then you can come back to them in your 20s or 30s or 40s or whatever, and you're getting something else out of them. So certainly when I was listening to the Beatles as a teen, I was listening to, you know, Revolver, Pepper, White Album Beatles. It took a while for me to actually think that, actually, Please Please Me, Hard Day's Night Beatles are fantastic. And now, you know, you might, you know, It's All Abbey Road is quite popular at the minute. So the fact is that, you know, depending on which way the light is falling on them, they're about 10 different bands, if you want.
I suppose following off that, kind of another question, I suppose. Because Elvis Presley, if he wasn't tied up making shit films for that decade, last decade of time, you could argue that he'd be still making music and he'd be very prolific, and the Beatles may not have had such a huge an impact as they did, because there was a bit of a chasm left because of that. So is that fair to say?
I think that is a fair comment, because rock had had a sort of peak and then had fallen away. So, you know, Elvis is in the army and then he comes out and starts making the shit films. You know, Little Richard had Find Religion. Jerry Lee Lewis was off, you know, country music. And the charts were full of back into that sort of slightly anodyne music. So there was a gap there. And I think there's something in that, that there was this kind of first flush of rock that had faded away and left the space for them to move into.
I think the thing I'd say about Elvis is, you look through all history, there's one common denominator, and that is the manager, the agent, you know, the person they're with. And all the great bands, you know, who've just got that little extra bit, had people at the time who were really, really good for them. And again, it comes back to Epstein being brilliant and Colonel Tom being the worst. Just the worst person. Period.
And he was out for himself.
Always.
And I suppose there's no denying the influence of the Beatles, but you could argue, and I've argued it's off mic. I know my place. Musically, they didn't exactly push themselves. I mean, you could argue that they, you know, towards the end, they get a bit more experimental. But about to jump across the table. Hang on. I have a point. But there's a lot of other bands around the same time, or just a little bit after, like Led Zeppelin or Pink Floyd or, you know, Beach Boys, or who kind of pushed it a lot more.
There's a fantastic book called The Act You've Known for All These Years by Clinton Halen, which kind of looks at popular music in 67 and does kind of touch upon that, because you buy it thinking it's a Beatles book, and actually it's a book, or the subtext of the book is, you know what, in 67 it's Floyd and Co. who kind of took the mantle and ran with it. And I think you could argue that people love to play this game of, well, who took over from the Beatles in terms of, you know, success and all the rest. And I think similarly to the Beatles, Floyd are kind of going the distance in a way that wasn't really obvious at the time. And you could also argue maybe Bowie has kind of, in the last 10 years, has reemerged as something that he wasn't in the 90s or noughties. Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, they're all fantastic. There doesn't have to be a winner. But, you know.
I think 67 is the year. So, I mean, I would say the Beatles are absolutely blazing a trail, and everyone else is following what they're doing and picking up on what they're doing. You get to 67, you get Sgt. Pepper, which is this great kind of cultural event, and then it's almost as if a decision has to be made. Do you stick with this psychedelic production studio, and you've got these other bands, you've got The Move, you've got Pink Floyd, who are really taking what the Beatles did in terms of psychedelic stuff and going off with that. You've got the San Francisco bands, you've got these kind of jam bands emerging, like the Grateful Dead and stuff like that, you know, the Doors. Then you've got the strip back. Dylan is going strip back. So I think 67 is the year in which the Beatles and all of these bands have to make a decision.
But it's also when you have this horrible division between, you know, pop and rock. That's, you know, this kind of Rolling Stoneism of rock, which drives me crazy.
I mean, my theory is that Sgt. Pepper is really the last sort of cross-generational appeal of the Beatles. You know, up to that point, the mums, the dads, the kids, the grannies, there's something there. And even on Sgt. Pepper, you've got, you know, When I'm 64, you've got nice little songs, you've got the kind of weird stuff coming in. By the time, and we touched on this in an earlier episode, Magical Mystery Tour is the darker flip side of that. So I think Sgt. Pepper, June 1967, is the peak of their cross-generational appeal. after that, they've lost their initial audience who are going to listen to the Monkees and put their two albums at number one in 67. The mums and dads are thinking, whoa, this is I Am the Walrus. So like, what's going on there? The whole Magical Mystery Tour thing. That's when the audience fractures.
Yeah.
And yes, it leads into this pop rock split.
Yeah.
That's interesting. And we were talking earlier on as well about Harry Nilsson.
Yes.
I know you're going to do an episode of that at some stage, but that was musically just all over the place, but in a good way. All right, a couple of last few quick fire round ones. Yoko broke with the Beatles?
No.
Okay. George Harrison was a more sincere singer and is than Paul McCartney?
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Yes.
No.
Sincere? Did you say sincere?
I said sincere, yeah. I think if you listen to, for me, and who I don't have a dog in this fight at all, but if you listen to, for me, if you listen to All Things Must Pass, when he's singing that, it's funny, it's heartbreaking, it's warm, it's lovely.
One of the reasons I like the early takes album so much is I don't think George is overthinking his vocals. I think sometimes his vocals are a bit.
I'm quite prepared to concede that of the three main vocalists in the Beatles, George is in at number three. I mean, he doesn't, you know, he doesn't have the strongest voice, but I think in terms of the question is about sincerity and about what he puts into the music. I honestly don't think there's any question.
Well,
you know,
we can get into a massive philosophical argument about who's being sincere, and I would argue that George doesn't need to be seen as being sincere because he's discussing spiritualistic stuff. Paul is also being sincere, but he's being sincere in his own plane. And his sincerity is to do with
in terms of
joy
putting,
and
putting himself
populism.
I think you can get a picture of the man, George Harrison, by listening to his music. I don't think you get that from Paul. There are exceptions where he is, you know, and when they happen, like Dear Friend, it's staggering because it's not what you expect, you know, because he's writing songs about engine drivers and you know, he's writing songs about little stories about Molly and, you know, Desmond, and you know, you don't get that from Harrison. So I think the answer is yes. So okay, let's move on.
The answer is yes as well, even though I think it's overshadowed because McCartney was more prolific and he just produced so much
great stuff.
Two more questions.
Okay.
So what did you set out to achieve with this podcast, and have you achieved it?
Oh, geez. We wanted to be rich beyond our wildest dreams.
Yes.
Check.
Money. Money. Send money now.
I think it's been a total lark. I don't think, and it's been very, if I can try and get my George sincerity on, I've been amazed at how many thousands of people around the world have interacted with the podcast this year, and it's been really, really good. We just set out to do it for fun to see what it would be, and
Because I mean, what I would say is this is all Jason's idea. So you know, Jason said, you know, I think it would be interesting to do a podcast. I mean, I don't know what my expectations were. I was maybe expecting, you know, that I knew there were at least half a dozen people.
Yes,
I knew that might listen to it for at least one or two episodes if we were lucky, and it has been incredibly kind of gratifying that people are engaging. People, there's been good feedback. People are saying nice things, or leaving reviews, but also, I mean, on Facebook and on Twitter, that there is that kind of engagement. And we have people listening in Guatemala City. Yeah. We have people listening in Australia and New Zealand. Yeah. It's amazing.
I didn't expect a year ago that it would be all this, like a Georgism. And I suppose the big thing was meeting and interviewing Mark Lewisohn was just...
Was that your highlight for the whole thing?
That was an absolute mind-blower to think that had happened. And he was amazing. He was fantastic.
That was just an email sent out on spec. He was going to be in Dublin, and he was, you know, amazingly gracious
and generous
with his time
and his patience
as I have to say have you
thank you and just back to the money that's resting in Jason's account because it was his idea. It's all in traveller's checks, though.
It's amazing how much money podcast
31st of December I'll be issuing appointing a receiver.
Mattress Mick will be one of our sponsors, I think. So I think there's only one other question that I have, I suppose. Is what other band comes close to the Beatles? Because it could be framed as, if you weren't doing a podcast with Beatles, what would you do about
it? It's really hard. I have actually thought about this. And it's really hard because the Beatles have the socio-cultural kind of thing that you can dive into as well. And we have a lot of historical information that you can dive into. So there's not really many other acts that you can pull that information together on, or that it would be even particularly interesting, I don't think, you know?
No, I mean, as you might imagine, we spend a lot of time listening to outtakes or different versions of studio chat. I'm not interested in outtakes of the Rolling Stones or the Who or the Kinks or that's my own personal...
I think the person who comes close is Dylan.
Is Dylan, yeah.
I don't know 1% as much about Dylan as I would need to run a Dylan podcast. I know there are some excellent Dylan podcasts out there, but he's certainly someone who does have a, you know, he's woven into the cultural fabric and he's got copious alternate dimensions that you can kind of explore. But I couldn't do a Dylan podcast. The type of artists I could talk about for an hour unscripted are probably, Elvis Costello or The Monkees or, Jeff. Yes. And there's a handful of others, but I don't think you'd be able to do it the way you do.
I agree with that. I mean, you could pick any band and do a podcast about, you know, album reviews, but I think Dylan is probably the only one that comes close, and he doesn't have the commercial impact. And I think arguably, and I know various people, Lucas Hare that run Kerry Shale that run the Is It Rolling
podcast, which is
an excellent Dylan podcast, will probably not speak to me for saying it, but I don't think he has the cultural impact that the Beatles, certainly in terms of global reach.
Well, the thing I love about the Beatles is that they were so huge. Like, they sold so many records. And we have this thing in nowadays where if something's popular, you're kind of programmed to think it's a bit crappy. And the Beatles did not meet that model. And it's something that really hasn't been matched much elsewhere, you know, that they were hugely popular with young and old, and they sold millions and millions of records. They were number one. They're still number one. Like, Abbey Road went to number one after 50 years this year. Huge numbers. But they don't meet the... I understand why people might be tired of the Beatles.
It's not disposable.
But it's not disposable, and it's not rubbish. It's really good, high art, and it's massively popular. Mm. And that is a really weird... Two things. They are often not side by side, those two things.
I think it's more often the case that quality and popularity do not kind of...
Bowie. I know it's... Probably for Bowie.
Bowie was there as well. And you probably could talk 70s Bowie. You could look at, you know, cultural legacy and what he did and all the rest. Yeah, there's a lot to talk about in Bowie as well. Where you do get, like, something that sells a lot that is actually really good and stands the test of time, it's that is curious. And then, you know, that whole notion of, like... The Who have just put out their 12th album this month in December 2019. The Beatles did 12 albums by 69, So it's the notion that it was basically seven acute years. Like, it's ridiculous to think, you know, I have a thing sitting on my TV recorder at home that celebrates the Beatles' arrival in America in 64, and it was on the telly in 2014, and I haven't watched it yet. It's been sitting on my hard drive longer than the Beatles made all those records, you know. It's really strange.
Well, I'll go back under the stairs. I'm sorry for the intrusion.
Yes.
And I'll talk to you this time next year.
You can get some more sunlight next year.
But see you then.
Thanks again, Ado, for all your hard work and everything you've done helping us bring this madness to the masses.
Thank you, and thank you for telling me all about Paul McCartney. He's just such a genius.
He's a great man. I suppose we'll better sign off for 2019. And once again, we want to thank all of you for listening all around the world, wherever you are. And we really are thankful for all the feedback. We are going to come back and we're going to jiggle up a couple of things. We have a couple of ideas for 2020. Yep. We want to talk about the anthology. We want to talk about Sgt. Pepper. We want to talk about Harry Nilsson. We've got a very rough list of where we're going to go. But we're going to, you know, go home, listen to our Christmas records, take it easy for a bit, regroup, and you'll hear from us in a few weeks' time. Thanks again for listening. We'll still be online in the usual places at Beatles Pod, on the Facebook group, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group. Do a search, ask Stephen to let you in, and thank you for all your kind feedback and reviews. Leave them wherever you get your podcasts. But for now and for 2019, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And you've been listening to season 1 of Nothing Is Real. We will see you very soon. Thank you very much.
Thank you.